From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Eleanor Roosevelt, her accomplishments in the White House, her unconventional marriage, and her ardent and turbulent relationship with another woman, reporter Lorena Hickok. We talk with historian Blanche Wiesen Cook, who has just completed the second volume of her biography of the former First Lady. Also, pianist Peter Minton returns to play and sing forgotten songs from Tin Pan Alley. His new CD features music by women songwriters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congress has overwhelmingly approved compromise legislation that would protect businesses from a potential flood of lawsuits related to the Y2K computer problem. The House and Senate passed the measure within hours of each other, and the White House says President Clinton will sign it. The administration negotiated some additional protections for consumers, but some Democrats are still unhappy with the bill. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Y2K litigation bill is a top priority for business, which fears a rush to the courthouse seeking redress for Y2K computer problems. After resisting the bill for some time on the grounds that it goes too far in restricting the rights of consumers, the White House finally agreed to sign the measure. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says he'll support the bill, but in his view it hasn't been improved nearly enough.
I'm disappointed that it doesn't go farther, and I'm convinced that there is a real possibility that we may have to revisit this question. And I wouldn't be surprised if the people demanding we revisit the question will be some of the very people who are advocating this bill.
The president drew grudging praise from GOP presidential candidate George W. Bush for reaching agreement on the Y2K bill. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
NATO's supreme military commander says he's skeptical of rumors that Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic is in danger of being overthrown. General Wesley Clark told the Senate Armed Services Committee that Milosevic retains formidable power in Yugoslavia and that he's an expert at dividing the opposition.
I see that the opposition is fragmented and weak. It's been traumatized by basically his campaign of covert terror against them.
Clark gave the Senate panel an update on peacekeeping efforts. President Clinton says it will be more than a tragedy if the Northern Ireland peace talks fall apart this week. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton says that he's been in virtual constant contact with all the parties involved in the deadline peace talks in Northern Ireland. In the last 24 hours, he's spoken with British Prime Minister Tony Blair three times to offer his help in resolving the dispute over the sequencing of IRA weapons decommissioning and the formation of a new Northern Ireland government. Today, he said it would be very hard for the world to understand if the talks break off.
If you have a situation where you've had two elections ratifying a peace agreement, and you have all the leaders saying that we all have to comply with every element of it, and it falls apart over sequencing, I think that it would be, to call it a tragedy would be a gross understatement.
But President Clinton says he's optimistic, and he believes the parties are determined to work things through to a positive conclusion. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 95 points to close at 11,066. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak said today that he'll meet with Israeli and Arab leaders in an effort to revive the Mideast peace negotiations. Mubarak spoke at a joint news conference with President Clinton today at the White House. President Clinton says he expects to host Israel's Prime Minister-elect Ehud Barak sometime soon. And the president said he believes there's now a real chance to move the peace process forward in the Middle East. President Mubarak said that he would meet with Barak, Syrian President Hafez Assad, and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. A two-year investigation into vote fraud in Miami is ending with 57 people charged. Investigators named 11 of them today. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports from Miami.
State prosecutors charged 11 people with changing their addresses so they could cast absentee ballots in the 1997 primary and general mayoral elections. Undercover agents posing as vote brokers followed up tips that absentee ballots were being bought and sold in Miami's Little Havana neighborhood. Those ballots, often cast by elderly Cuban Americans, gave Xavier Suarez the edge in the election. The vote was later thrown out by a federal judge. A Miami city commissioner implicated in the vote fraud scheme is serving jail time. There are new safeguards in place to avert absentee ballot fraud, and Florida law enforcement officials say they're closing the investigation. Cheryl Duvall, NPR News, Miami.
Business picked up at the nation's factories in June, growing for the fifth month in a row. The National Association of Purchasing Management said 16 of the 20 industries in its monthly survey reported an improvement in business. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After FDR was elected president in 1932, Eleanor Roosevelt worried that her talents would not be used, that she would become a White House shut-in, a congenial hostess in the political shadows. That's how Blanche Wieson Cook begins the second volume in her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, which covers the years 1933 to 38. The newly published book goes on to document how Eleanor Roosevelt countered her fear by becoming an activist First Lady. The book also describes the Roosevelts' unconventional marriage. During the White House years, Eleanor and Franklin had separate quarters and separate courts. FDR's closest companion was his secretary, Missy LaHand. Eleanor's closest companion was Lorena Hickok, perhaps the most prominent woman reporter of the time. My guest, Blanche Wieson Cook, is a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York. Cook says Eleanor Roosevelt transformed the role of First Lady.
Well, she really is an activist in the White House. You know, she's the only First Lady in U.S. history who actually reaches for her pen when she disagrees with her husband. She disagrees with him about his very first act, which is the Economy Act, which results in the firing of federally employed women. And Eleanor Roosevelt is outraged. She writes, "This is a stupid, foolish, unnecessary act." She disagrees with him about international relations and writes an entire book called This Troubled World in 1938. Why doesn't he support the World Court? Why doesn't he understand the need for a League of Nations? Why doesn't he promote collective security? You know, these are all burning issues with her. And she writes about these things. She speaks about them. She was very angry that Social Security in 1935 came in segregated. And she went on a national speaking tour saying, this is a law that's going to have to be amended every single year. It's really quite an extraordinary feat that Eleanor Roosevelt performed.
By the time Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt entered the White House, did they have an intimate marital relationship, or were they just kind of strong companions?
Well, I think I don't answer those questions because I say very clearly we don't know what people actually do in the privacy of their privacy. But it's very clear that Missy LaHand lives in the White House. Missy LaHand is treated by Eleanor Roosevelt as the junior wife.
And Missy LaHand was FDR's personal secretary and also his close companion.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, she had a very hard time with Lucy Mercer, who was the first woman who really almost crashed their marriage. And Eleanor Roosevelt really never adjusted to Lucy Mercer, but she adjusted completely to Missy LaHand, who after 1920 was FDR's most, important and intimate associate and friend and assistant, and picked up all of the social obligations that Eleanor Roosevelt, in her many travels, didn't do.
In Volume 2 of your biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, you describe her relationship with Lorena Hickok as the most ardent and absorbing relationship of Eleanor Roosevelt's middle years. You first wrote about their relationship in Volume 1 of your book and, implied that their relationship might have been an intimate one. What kind of reaction did you get from readers who thought that even the thought of Eleanor Roosevelt as possibly having had a lesbian relationship was shocking?
Well, I was actually surprised by the outrage some people felt at the possibility that Eleanor Roosevelt had love in her life. There were people who came up to me at parties, including a human rights worker who said, "Oh, are you that disgusting woman?" And I said, "Well, I might be, but, you know, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, did you write that book about Eleanor Roosevelt having lesbian friends or a lesbian affair or some such thing?" And I asked her if she'd read the book, and she said, "No, I wouldn't read it. I wouldn't touch it." And this woman was a human rights worker and a writer, and it really gave me great pause. There's an incredible amount of just bigotry and refusal to contemplate that Eleanor Roosevelt had love in her life, whether it was with Lorena Hickok or with Earl Miller. And I think there really are people who just don't want to hear this. On the other hand, I feel that what I do here, without characterizing the relationship, is simply tell the story. And I feel very free to tell the story because Eleanor Roosevelt left us the documents. She wrote to her daughter, "I'm giving all my letters to the library. You remove anything you don't want history to know." And since Eleanor Roosevelt intended us to have this record, I think she intended us to know, you know, some of the struggles that she endured as a woman who intended to live a very full life. And I'd also like to say, you know, this is not merely a romantic and delightful story, because it's a very changing story. At some point, Lorena Hickok gives up her career. And when Hick gives up her career, the nature and the intensity of the relationship changes.
Well, first of all, why did she give up her career? We should say that Lorena Hickok was the most highly paid woman journalist of her time. She wrote for the Associated Press and, in fact, met Eleanor Roosevelt because she was covering Eleanor Roosevelt shortly before Eleanor Roosevelt came to the White House. So,
that's the story. I mean, not only was she covering Eleanor Roosevelt, she was actually covering FDR. She was the highest paid woman reporter, but she was the woman reporter assigned to presidential politics. She didn't do first ladies. I mean, this was a very powerful, influential Associated Press reporter. And she gave up her job because she got too close, as Louis Howe, their mutual friend, said to her, "You should never get too close to your news sources." And she couldn't tell all that she knew as the children's divorces were coming in. She couldn't tell the secrets of her best friend. And so she resigned. And Eleanor Roosevelt encouraged her to resign and never fully appreciated what it would mean to Hick, who had worked so hard to become, you know, the number one woman in the game, to give up her life's work. The moral is never give up your career for the woman or man you love.
How did it change the relationship?
She became unhappy. She became depressed. She became dependent. And Eleanor Roosevelt had part of the excitement about Hick was that she was so independent, was that she was such a self-starter. She was really Eleanor Roosevelt's guide. And when she became depressed and unhappy and grumpy, it really hurt. But not only that, she expected for her great, effort in this relationship, she expected to have a unique relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor Roosevelt was really involved with the political world around her, and she couldn't give Hick the kind of time and the kind of attention that she needed. And it's a big part of the story.
Couldn't Lorena Hickok have just changed beats so that she wouldn't have been expected to report on the Roosevelts?
Well, Terry, you know, I said it's a big part of the story. There's a great big push-pull in this relationship. She says to Eleanor Roosevelt at one point, "I'm going to go off and be a foreign correspondent." And Eleanor Roosevelt says, "No, don't go. I want you here. I want you near me." And every time she starts to push away or pull away, Eleanor Roosevelt pushes or pulls her back. And that's a very big part of the dynamic between them.
I believe a lot of what you learned about the relationship between Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok come from their correspondence, which was made open to scholars after Lorena Hickok's papers were opened in 1978. Can you read excerpts of one or two of the letters that you think are most enlightening about the nature of their relationship?
Well, there are two, actually. You know, one is on page 42, and Eleanor Roosevelt writes, "One day marked off, my dear, may I forget there are other reporters present, or must I behave? I shall want to hug you to death. I can hardly wait. The nicest time of the day is when I write to you. You have a stormier time than I do, but I miss you as much, I think. I couldn't bear to think of you crying yourself to sleep. Oh, how I wanted to put my arms about you in reality instead of in spirit. Please keep most of your heart in Washington as long as I'm here, for most of mine is with you." And that, of course, is early in 1933, when the love and longing and pining is really still at its height. Then there's another one on page 187, and this is, you know, really kind of evidence of how far apart they've gotten in a very short time, as politics and history and time really intrudes on their happiness. "Hick, dearest, I know how you felt today. You couldn't let go for fear of losing control, and being with me was hard. Darling, I love you dearly, and I am sorry for letting my foolish temperament make you unhappy, and sorry that your temperament does bad things to you, too. But we'll have years of happy times, so bad times will be forgotten." And there are two themes here that are repeated over and over. One is every time they're apart, their longing is extreme and intense. And then when they get together, they're expectations tend to crash. And then Eleanor Roosevelt writes immediately thereafter, you know, "When I'm free of these obligations, you know, we will go off together, we will live together, we will retire someplace." And she makes really very amazing and vast promises. And then even they begin to taper off. So it is a very turbulent and stormy relationship.
How long did their relationship last?
Well, actually, their friendship lasted throughout Eleanor Roosevelt's life. I mean, she dies 10 years before Hick does, and they are friends to the end of their life. I actually think the passionate and stormy part really begins to end by 1935, when Eleanor Roosevelt makes a great decision that politics is her primary love, and she just doesn't have time or space or temperament for the kind of demands that Hick makes. There's one moment where Eleanor Roosevelt arrives in New York after she's called Hick and said, you know, "Meet me at the train and we'll have a private weekend." And she gets off the train with Tommy, her secretary, Malvina Thompson, who is, you know, her very dear and devoted friend. And she's gone up on the train with her to take dictation and help write articles and do all the things Tommy made possible. And Hick sees them get off the train together, and she just storms away. And it's that kind of tension that at some point Eleanor Roosevelt decides she just can't handle and do all the work she wants to do.
You said you don't really want to characterize the relationship between Roosevelt and Hickok. You just want to describe what it is that they've said to or about each other, because that's all the evidence you have to go on. So does that mean that you don't feel certain how physically intimate they were with each other, or whether it was just the intimacy of friendship that they're describing?
Well, what I said is I leave it up to the reader, and I prefer not to characterize it, but it's very clear to me that this is an ardent, passionate, intimate relationship.
What did Franklin Roosevelt think of the relationship between his wife and Lorena Hickok?
Well, I actually think Franklin was relieved that his wife had friendships outside of their own partnership, because he had friendships that were very important to him outside their partnership. And I think he encouraged his wife to have friends. He encouraged the building of Val Kill with Nancy Cook and Marion Dickerman. I think he was relieved and grateful for Eleanor Roosevelt's friends. And I talk about how chummy he is with Hick and with all of the people in Eleanor Roosevelt's life.
My guest is Blanche Wiesen Cook. Volume 2 of her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt has just been published. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Blanche Wiesen Cook, and we're discussing the second volume in her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, which has just been published. You write, Eleanor Roosevelt and FDR didn't have a traditional, correct, or conventionally happy marriage, but it was one of Washington's most notably successful marriages. Fueled by power, they were each dedicated to making life better for most people. Together, they did more than either could have done alone. Is that really the basis of their marriage, their political interests, and their political alliance?
Well, I think it is the basis of their political alliance and their enduring friendship. I want to say one other thing, which is that I believe Eleanor Roosevelt loved Franklin to the day he died. He couldn't have hurt her so much if she didn't love him so much. And so there is always a part of her heart that is in pain, even though, because she's a competitive woman, she intends to, you know, make the best of this and have her very own life.
Did she have an understanding with her husband about what political domain would be hers, where it was, like, quote, okay for her to become an activist, and where the president really wanted her to stay quiet or out of the picture?
Yes, I think they really did have an agreement. She never did anything that would really hurt him. And when he tells her, very often there are memos to her, which I quote in the book, saying, you know, write nothing, do nothing, say nothing about this. And there's one issue which Eleanor Roosevelt maintains complete silence. And I have a chapter in the book called A Silence Beyond Repair. And that has to do with the silence both FDR and ER maintained for, you know, so long, from 1933 to 1938, about what was happening in Hitler's Germany and what was happening to Jews all over Europe. And this is a terrible story, because what we have from Eleanor Roosevelt's record is everything that came into her. The realities of what was going on in Dachau were printed in the Reader's Digest and sent to Eleanor Roosevelt in a very pained letter in 1934. So it's a very bitter story. And at one point, I didn't even want to finish the book. It was such a bitter story until I heard, I read quite by accident in Varian Fry's memoir, Nothing I Could Have Done to Save the 2,000 Jews. And this is the man, you know, the Holocaust Museum had an exhibit on Varian Fry. He saved the best and the brightest, people like Pablo Casals, Marc Chagall, Hannah Arendt, on and on. And he said, nothing I did could have been done had it not been for Eleanor Roosevelt. And I realized I was looking in the wrong place. I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt actually had, you know, a kind of covert operation when it came to international affairs. This was true for the Spanish Civil War, and it was true for refugees. She really did everything she could to save individual lives. And then one of the compelling aspects of the story is how she dealt with what was going on in Europe by committing herself to fight injustice in the United States, anti-Semitism in the United States, race hatred in the United States. So A Silence Beyond Repair is a very important and very disturbing, haunting part of the story.
My guest is Blanche Wiesen Cook, and she's just published the second of her multi-volumed biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, and the second volume begins in 1933 and ends in 1938. I think a lot of Americans prefer it if their first ladies are glamorous. And, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt was a physically plain-looking woman, and her buck teeth had the potential of making her kind of awkward-looking. I'm wondering if she was ever uncomfortable or insecure about her looks, if she thought much about, you know, whether she was attractive and whether that mattered.
I think she did. I think that was the one area that she was vulnerable. She hated how she looked. Although I have to say, and I met Eleanor Roosevelt many times, she was very striking. She had, you know, she was 6 feet tall. She wore clothes beautifully. She cared a lot about costumes. And she had the most incredible blue eyes. And once she had a car accident and her teeth were, she had new teeth, she was very attractive. And if you look at the pictures in the book, she really isn't as homely as she thinks she is, but she's very self-conscious about how she looks. And her cousin, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, constantly mocks how she looks in print and on the radio. And Eleanor Roosevelt, she could make Eleanor Roosevelt cry. So that too is a theme in the book. But that was the only area that she was vulnerable to criticism.
If you had the chance to actually ask Eleanor Roosevelt a question, what would you most want to clear up that still confuses you about her life?
Well, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt left the most amazing record. She is so clear and direct about what she thinks and what she wants that there's not a whole lot of confusion. I mean, I don't feel there's a whole lot of confusion about her public life. What is confusing is what was the nature of, for example, her relationship with Earl Miller. This is a very important friendship to Eleanor Roosevelt.
He had been her bodyguard.
He had been her bodyguard, and he remains her page and her squire and best friend. You know, it's Earl Miller who gives her the rambunctious dogs that nip at other people and bite, particularly women of the press. And he's trained these dogs. I don't know if he's trained them specifically to bite women of the press, but that's who they bite. And he's there. He's, you know, he's just part of her court. And every single one of his letters has disappeared. So that's certainly a relationship we don't know enough about. The letters to Lorena Hickok burned the first year of their correspondence, which one can only presume was the most ardent year of their relationship. And then she typed out the political part. And so there are things that we just don't know that were lost to history. So it's really in the relationships that I would want yet more detail.
Blanche Wiesencook, Volume 2 of her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, has just been published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from Time magazine, this week, results from a Time Nickelodeon survey revealing children's views on their parents, as well as on religion, guns and violence, and the future. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, pianist Peter Minton plays and sings forgotten songs from Tin Pan Alley. His new CD features music by women songwriters. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I'm grateful to my guest, Peter Minton, for keeping alive many great but forgotten songs from Tin Pan Alley and early movie musicals. He's a pianist who recently started singing, which means his listeners now get to hear the great lyrics to these old songs. He often performs at classy piano bars. He returns to Bemelman's Bar at the Carlyle Hotel in New York at the end of the month. Minton's new CD is a tribute to the women of Tin Pan Alley. We invited him for a return visit to perform in our studio. Let's start with a song by composer Dana Swiss, whose best-known songs are You Ought to Be in Pictures and The Night is Young and You're So Beautiful. Minton knew Swiss and now owns and plays her piano. This song, Moon About Town, was written for Ziegfeld Follies of 1934. The lyric is by Yip Harburg.
Manhattan is really as grand as it's painted. So tell me, you moon in the clouds, how does a stranger in town get acquainted among all these nonchalant crowds? You know each corner and a hideaway. You know your way about. I guess I'll just throw my pride away and ask you to take me out. Moon, what's your program, you moon about town? Moon, be my escort and to show me around. Where does one go, moon? What does one do when one's alone, moon? I'm asking you. Moon, in this city of millions of lights, is there someone else wasting your nights? Tell her about me. Don't turn me down. Moon, introduce us, you moon about town.
Performed for us by Peter Minton. On your new CD, Yours for a Song, you revive a song by a composer named Bernice Petcare.
Yes.
A composer I've never heard of, although one of her songs is very well known, and I never knew it was written by a woman, or that it was written by her in particular. And that song is Close Your Eyes.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you to do a lesser-known song of hers, which is just the opposite of Close Your Eyes. Close Your Eyes is like a dreamy ballad.
Oh, yes.
And the song I'm going to ask you to do, which is also on your new CD, is a very up-tempo novelty tune. Tell us about the song before you play it and how you discovered it.
Well, I collect 78s, and I found a record of Johnny Green and his dance orchestra, which recorded for Brunswick Records in Columbia in the mid-30s. And Johnny made a record of this song, and I looked at the title, and I looked at the composer, and I thought, gee, that's strange. Bernice Pitcairn, who had written such kind of melancholy songs like this one, you know, Close Your Eyes. And another one she wrote was Lullaby of the Leaves, which goes... And so Mile a Minute is quite the opposite in feeling. And I might add that Bernice Pitcairn is one of the lady songwriters that also wrote her own lyrics at times. Close Your Eyes is her lyric, and A Lullaby of the Leaves is Joe Young, but A Mile a Minute is all hers, and it was copyrighted in 1934. Here it is. Kiss will do when you feel you're forlorn. I need love to make me happy today. Steamboat, blow your whistle. Locomotive, toot your horn. Traffic cop, keep people out of my way. A mile a minute, a block a second, I'll beat all records, it's true, 'cause I'll be traveling a mile a minute to you. A mile a minute, my heart is pounding, my knees are shivering too, 'cause I'll be traveling a mile a minute to you. I'll take a boat, a train, a bus, an aeroplane to your door. And if that plane is slow, I'll dig a tunnel and come right up through your parlor floor. A mile a minute, a block a second, soon you'll be saying I flew right in your arms. A mile a minute to you.
That's Peter Minton performing A Mile a Minute, which he also does on his new CD, which is a tribute to the women of Tin Pan Alley. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us at the piano is Peter Minton, who's been described as an archaeologist of great songs. Peter, you play a lot of, you've played your share of swank hotels, and you play 6 months a year at the Hotel Carlisle in New York, at Bellman's Bar there. And I'm wondering if the people in the real swank hotels are any more attentive than people in cheaper clubs and bars.
I have to be very diplomatic, Terry, in answering that question, but every single night is different, and every hour is different in the evening. It's funny, some nights I might come in to start working at 9:30, and there will be maybe four couples, and they're sitting there just waiting for me, and they love every single thing I do, and they applaud, and they ask for the right requests, you know. And then
An hour later, for example, a reception might have ended at the Whitney Museum, which is a couple of blocks downtown, and they all come in and they all want to smoke and drink and raise hell. And so, well, my idea is I want everyone to feel comfortable and have a good time, so I'm not about to stand up and tell them to be quiet.
One of the controversies in restaurants now is whether or not patrons should be using cell phones while they're sitting alone and eating. It annoys a lot of people.
That is a very annoying thing, cell phones. In fact, as I was describing, coming to work early sometimes, there'll be very few people, and I'm playing a nice soft ballad, let's say, like, close your eyes, rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. And then you hear, breep, breep. Reep, reep. And somebody who's got his cell phone. And for some reason, I don't know why this is, why don't they answer them? If it were you, and of course with you that would never happen, or with me, you'd answer it so it wouldn't ring anymore.
I think people can't find it because they've got it in a briefcase or in a purse and they can't get it out. But anyways, you have a song, you have a song, don't you, to answer the people who are on cell phones and whose cell phone beeps interrupt your ballads.
I've been trying to think of something to do when these cell phones go off from time to time because I think it's tacky. And so I thought I'd be subtle, and at first I was doing this song. Remember this? All alone, I'm so all alone. There is no one left but, no one else but you. Then the second line is all alone. By the telephone, waiting for a ring, a ting-a-ling. That was too subtle. No one seemed to care. And so I asked my friends, I said, I asked Bruce Goldstein, of course, can you write me a parody of something? I need a telephone song. I want something that's humiliating and charming at the same time.
Did you find something humiliating and charming?
I think I did. It's one of the newest songs I know. It's from 1947. Would you like to hear it?
Absolutely.
In fact, it's a very lovely piece. If you just listen to the musical part of this, it could have been a wonderful ballad, but it turns into something quite different. I said that I'd wait for you forever. Darling, I meant every word I said. The thought of not waiting forever never entered my head. I've been waiting for your phone call for 18 years. Maybe you don't love me anymore. How long must I wait for you to keep our date? Could it be, sweetheart, that you are sore? I've been waiting for your phone call for 18 years. You told me you'd call me back that day. I'm wasting my youth in a telephone booth. How could you treat your only love this way? I was young and healthy when you left me. Has your love grown cold? You're acting strange. Could it be your fickle, or didn't you have the nickel? If you'd had written, I'd have sent the change. I've been waiting for your phone call for 18 years. Could it be that you found someone new? I'll wait for your phone call for 18 more. But after that, we are through.
And so when you play that at a place where cell phones have interrupted your performance, do people get it? People turn their cell phone off afterwards?
Not at all.
No. It's a good song anyways.
In fact, the one time my timing was perfect when I got somebody and I sang that song. They came over to me while I was singing it and asked me to play Moon River. And I said, I'll be with you in a minute. I'm singing a song right now.
Maybe they thought it was the equivalent of call waiting.
Oh, another time, someone brought the cell phone and put it on the piano and said, this is my wife's favorite song. It was not what I was... It was something like, they can't take that away from me. I was playing, and he said, this is my wife's favorite song. Can we call her and you can sing it to her? So I put the cell phone on the piano. I couldn't believe it.
Now, something else I'm sure you run into when you're playing at hotel bars is cigarette smoke. People still allowed to smoke in the bars that you play?
Yeah, it's not like California.
They can't in California, but they can in New York?
That's right. Oh, cigars, cigarettes, yeah.
Now, there used to be a lot of great cigarette songs, and I know that you know many of them. Do you do them in your performances?
Oh, I love to do that because the funny thing is, songs about smoking became very unfashionable. And one tends to forget that there was a naive period in this century when songs about cigarettes were considered very kind of romantic and sexy, because if you were having a cigarette, it meant that you were, you know, prolonging your evening, and that you just didn't want to leave. You wanted to have another cigarette. And in fact, that's one of the songs I do is called Let's Have Another Cigarette. But there are quite a few.
Play us a few lines of some of the cigarette songs.
Well, it appears in a lot of songs in fragments, but for example, in Sophisticated Lady, I see you now, smoking, drinking, never thinking of tomorrow, nonchalant. And then this song, a cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, as we enjoy a Nicorette, I mean cigarette, to some exquisite chansonette, while a cigarette was burning, my heart was burning too, a smoke ring for your finger, I fashioned in the blue. Don't get me started.
Very nice. That's Peter Minton at the piano. And Peter Minton has a new CD called Yours for a Song. And that CD features songs by women Tin Pan Alley composers. Peter Minton also plays about 6 months a year at Bemelman's Bar, which is in the Carlyle Hotel in Manhattan. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joining us at the piano is Peter Minton. His new CD is a tribute to the women of Tin Pan Alley. Peter, the last time you were here, which was about 3 years ago, you had just started to sing more in your performances because you were mostly playing piano. So have you been singing more and more? This new CD is the first CD that you sing on. So what's it been like to sing more, and how's that been going for you?
Oh, well, my friends couldn't believe it. No, really, because all my life I refused to sing.
Uh-huh.
I never sang. I mean, I was in the boys' glee for a while, but until I could become the pianist for boys' glee, then I didn't have to sing anymore. I mean, I didn't want to sing. And then later in life, I started thinking, well, gee, I'm going to New York now to start playing at the Carlyle, and I've got to do something different because it's getting kind of boring playing music, and people don't know what it is much of the time, but if you sing it, then they know what it is.
Well, I'm glad you're singing, because you get, you know, so many obscure songs that nobody else knows, and you get the full song that way.
Well, you know who's encouraging to me, who's not here to take the thanks, is people like Louis Armstrong, Johnny Mercer, Hoagy Carmichael, Fred Astaire, people who a lot of folks don't look at as singers, but they sang, you know, because I'm not a trained singer, and I'm just trying to get across a lyric, and it's great being my own accompanist, too.
Well, I think you probably find a lot of your songs from old movies and sheet music. One of the songs that you do, I consider it to just be a found song, and it's not a song that you'd hear on the radio. It's a song called GE is Everywhere. Peter, what is this? Is this an early commercial?
Yes. In collecting records, my friends found this 10-inch 78, which was pressed by RCA Victor in 1934, and all it says is the Matrix number and Jack Whiting's name, who was a Broadway star and a film star, singing GE is Everywhere.
And yeah, we have to hear it.
Okay.
What inspired you to actually learn the song?
Oh, do I have to answer that?
Yes.
I learned this song because I wanted something to play that was completely stupid when the when the crowds at the bar are so noisy that they can't hear me anyway. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere. GE is yours to use and share. Paris or Berlin, North Pole or Equator, all is chilly in your refrigerator with General Electric light. Your room is sunny at night, and on your radio, 10 or 3 tubes with GE tubes, you'll get everywhere. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere. GE is yours to use and share. Paris or Berlin, North Pole or Equator, all is chilly in your refrigerator with General Electric light. Your room is sunny at night. For everything you do, cooking, roasting, baking, toasting, GE works for you.
Did you ever have anybody from GE in an audience when you performed that who could tell you something about the song?
No, I haven't. And people have seldom mentioned that they even heard the song. It's for those noisy nights.
I think they still use "For Everything You Do" in some of their ads, yeah. I may be wrong, but I think they do. I'm going to ask you, Peter, to choose a song to close with that you particularly love, and that you particularly love now, something that you're really enamored with now.
Oh, thank you. Well, there is a song with music by Sam Coslow that was published in England only, and I believe it's from 1934 or 5, and it's a lovely ballad. You know, one of the things I thought I would never do is like ballads.
Why?
Well, most people like ballads, but I always thought they were boring and depressing and too torchy and blue. But now I have such a good time learning them and singing them, and this is one. And it's called Some Other Time. And if you know Sam Coslow, he wrote for a lot of films, including he wrote the song Black Moonlight from Too Much Harmony, in which you hear the same rhymes, neglected and rejected. And he also wrote My Old Flame and Cocktails for Two and tremendous Hollywood songs.
You seem to think it clever keeping me out in the cold. You're saying goodbye forever before you do. I'm warning you, some other time you'll remember our nights of romance. Some other time you'll be begging me for just one more chance. Wait till you're neglected, rejected by those you are keen on. Oh, how you will run to the one who you feel will be there to lean on. Some other moon may be shining on some other night. Some other June you'll be singing our song of delight. And when at last you return, sadder but wiser, you'll learn. Some other time may be too late, sweetheart.
What a pleasure to have you back on Fresh Air. Thank you so much for being with us and for performing for us.
Thank you for asking.
Peter Minton's new CD is a tribute to the women of Tin Pan Alley. He lives in San Francisco. At the end of this month, he returns to Manhattan to perform at Bemelman's Bar in the Carlyle Hotel. Our concert engineer was Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of White Oleander by Janet Fitch, in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, as the holiday weekend begins, we talk about traveling through the sky and why the sky remains a strange and exotic place. We hear from pilot William Longavisha, author of Inside the Sky, a meditation on flight. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.